This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
And on the 10th day, well, we don't know yet about the 10th day, but things are looking good, I'll tell you that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 10th of October. It's Thursday. Good as always to have you with us. And there is a point to be made here about deadlines concentrating the mind, about looming economic apocalypse being enough to convince Republicans in the House of Representatives that this was the time to make a deal with the White House, because it seems there is a deal afoot. Marketplace's David Gura is who we talk to when things are happening in Washington. He's on the line now. Hey, David.
Back again. Hey, Kai.
Back again. That's right. We can't get rid of you. Can't shut you down. What do we know? What are they talking about?
Well, this morning, the House Speaker, John Boehner, got all the House Republicans together. They met up at the Capitol, and Speaker Boehner presented a plan that he's currently presenting to President Obama at the White House. And Republicans would agree to raise the debt limit for 6 weeks. That would take us right up to Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And in exchange for that, and this is where things get a bit vague, Kai, okay, is that if President Obama agrees to do that, to sit down, and he would agree sort of to sit down and discuss a way forward. And those are Speaker Boehner's words, to reopen the government and to start to deal with America's pressing problems. So what I'll point out is there was nothing really concrete in what the speaker said this morning when it came to ending the government shutdown.
Right.
As I said, representatives of the House, Republicans, including Speaker Boehner, working this out with the president.
6 weeks, month and a half, not a whole lot of time. How much of a balm will that be for this whole thing, do you think?
Not a heavy-duty balm. I think maybe sort of like a non-prescription type salve, something like that. But I talked to Guy LaBob about this today. He's the chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott, and somebody who follows the bond market really closely.
Well, I mean, to some degree, it's like slapping a small bandage on a missing limb. You know, it's not that effective for the really big underlying problem, but it does sort of staunch the bleeding for the short term.
Mm-hmm. So investors like him who have a really long-term focus aren't thrilled with these short-term extensions. But he told me that the upside to this, is if it goes through, is that we'd be out of crisis mode, and that would be good for everybody.
I am obliged to ask here, David, about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which was the genesis of this whole thing on the Republican side. Ain't nobody talking about that now, man.
Yeah, a week has passed, more than a week, and it's kind of astonishing how little we're talking about it. I mean, there have been some stories, including some from our man Dan Gorenstein up in Philadelphia, about these exchanges, but it doesn't seem to be about Obamacare anymore. And what I will say is that if we get six more weeks without worrying about the debt ceiling, you know, there's a chance that some of these Republicans in the House might make it an issue again. But you're right, it's certainly not the issue that it was last week.
Traders on Wall Street had themselves a field day today on these rumors. Help me make some sense of that, would you?
Yeah, you're going to do the numbers, and I don't want to upstage you, but the market
seemed... Oh, go ahead.
Pretty thrilled that something is happening, that we have a proposal, that there have been meetings at the White House with Democrats and with Republicans. I talked to Kevin Logan about this. He's the chief U.S. economist at HSBC, and he told me that investors who are in it for the long haul believe that Washington's going to work this out eventually.
I think most people in the market believe that if there was such a default, it would only last a few days or a week at most, and eventually the Treasury would make good on all those securities. You would get your money back.
So he says investors sort of want to know what the end game is going to be, and even if they can't see that, what's satisfying them, at least for the time being, is that there is some movement, and at some point this is going to get resolved.
Yeah, all right. I'm now going to ask you a question that's going to take like 3 minutes to answer, but you've only got 30 seconds. Is it not bananas to start talking about gradations of default here?
You know, and that's sort of what's been happening here over these last few days. And I think that, you know, we have a week until we hit this date on which the Treasury Secretary said we'll no longer be able to pay our bills. So some time left. But that is sort of what it's come to here in Washington over these last few days.
David Gura at our bureau in Washington. More surely on this story later on. David, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
As I said, traders did enjoy themselves today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, from domestic to foreign affairs now. After talking things over for a number of weeks, the White House has decided to cut some aid to the Egyptian government. Not all of it, just a sliver, really, in the grand scheme of things. $260 million out of $1.5 billion in aid and assistance Egypt gets from the United States every year. Kimberly Adams is in Cairo. Kimberly, it's good to talk to you again.
Likewise.
Given how involved the Egyptian military is in the economy over there, how much of this aid that comes from the States do you think is actually going to trickle down?
Not much of it, actually. Because the military is such a huge monolithic organization, they pretty much keep everything of themselves to themselves. They have their own factories to provide all their own resources. They have their own sporting clubs. They make their own uniforms. And so what gets to the military pretty much stays with the military.
Yeah. Last time we talked to you, there were lines at gas stations. There was a curfew. Daily life was being interrupted. What's it like now? What's going on?
It's sort of a new normal. People are now kind of getting back to a rhythm of things. School just started. The curfew's been pushed back to midnight. And so a lot of the business impacts that we were seeing in terms of late night businesses not being able to operate, now they're able to function. But at the same time, the protests are still happening every weekend. There's still a lot of violence. And so this makes people very, very tense. So you're finding that maybe they're not spending as much. I've spoken to several small business owners who are saying that they are just being devastated because people aren't really investing in any sort of big ticket items. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, that's also because food prices are going up. Inflation is actually up like 10%.
Kimberly, it's been, what, 2.5 something years now since the initial revolution. It's been Mubarak. It's been Morsi. It's been the army. It's been the army twice now, actually. Is there a sense that anybody can deliver on what Egyptians want, you know, infrastructure and stable prices and all of that?
I think a lot of your average Egyptians are kind of giving up on that, especially when it comes to something like tourism. But at the same time, I'm hearing people just saying, you know, only God can save us is a very common refrain here, that only God can get us out of this mess. But at the same time, there's a lot of hope with the military, given that the military is such a respected institution in Egypt, and since they're playing such a strong role in government now, that maybe, just maybe, they would be able to do something to make this situation just a little bit better.
Kimberly Adams in Cairo for us. Kimberly, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Just because you haven't heard enough about the Affordable Care Act lately, get a load of this. Coming soon to your favorite television dramas, plot lines about health insurance and the aforementioned Affordable Care Act. Hollywood Health and Society, that's a program at the University of Southern California, got a $500,000 grant this week from the California Endowment to help Hollywood writers tell better stories about the new health insurance law. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill tells that story for us.
Health insurance is a favorite for TV writers. You can make it dramatic, romantic even, like Grey's Anatomy.
I have great medical insurance.
Way to kick a guy when he's down.
I'm saying that I'll marry you.
I'm tearing up. You can also go straight up goofy, like Scrubs.
When a patient doesn't have insurance, you have to work around the system. First, you have to find someone who's recently died.
Cool, Mr. Rabinowitz just kicked it.
Marty Kaplan is the director of the Norman Lear Center, home of Hollywood Health and Society. He says people learn from TV.
Even if they know it's fiction, even if they know that writers can make stuff up, especially in the realm of medicine and public health, if a doctor says something to a patient, people tend to think that someone has checked that, that it's true.
Kaplan's group works to make sure that at least some of what comes out of TV doctors' mouths is real, real-ish. Hollywood Health and Society has worked with nearly 100 TV shows, everything from Mad Men to Desperate Housewives to Dr. Vegas and The Bold and the Beautiful. It has access to the megaphone that is Hollywood, and that's appealing to Daniel Zingali from the California Endowment. He says as part of the grant, Hollywood Health and Society will reach out to TV writers and editors.
They'll be giving them content, storylines, information, so that people watching those programs will learn about Obamacare and useful information about how they can get enrolled.
Now, I'm with you here. This sounds like propaganda and politics and terrible television. But it doesn't have to be any of those. Neil Baer is executive producer of Under the Dome. He wrote for years on ER and Law & Order SVU.
Well, there's a difference between actors talking about what their political views are and a television show taking seriously all the strands of the conflict.
The health insurance law takes away a few of writers' favorite plot lines, like the evil insurance company that denies coverage. But it'll add others, good and bad.
Always what's important is to explain the story through the characters and what the characters are going through, not just do a lesson in what the Affordable Care Act is.
Baer thinks our politicians have failed to teach that lesson, failed to tell stories that help us understand, setting up a political drama that may also become fodder for TV writers. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When an author comes to me with a book of short stories, my response is always, oh dear.
I guess the Nobel Prize check might help with that, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. There you go, the really happy music, because the Dow Industrials climbed 323 points, 2.1%, closed at 15,126. The NASDAQ bounced up 82 points, 2.25%, 3760. The S&P 500 shimmied up 36 points, 2.1% there as well, closed at 1692. Best Buy led the charge, rose 7.5% after it confirmed it's going to launch a one-week smartphone trade-in program. Netflix posted a 5.4% gain today after analysts gave it a buy rating. Nike rang up 3.5% after it raised its earnings estimate. J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo both in the black ahead of their earnings announcement tomorrow. Wells galloped up 2.6%. Chase banked a 3.5% gain today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose again, I'm obliged to add. 2.69% is the yield there. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. The Nobel Peace Prize is announced. Last year, it was awarded to the European Union. And in tech history, on October 11, 1887, a patent was issued to Dore Eugene Felt for a device he called the Comptometer, an adding machine. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We've been talking to people this week who aren't in the government, who don't work for the government, but who are nonetheless really feeling the shutdown. Small business owners who are trying to get by without the government in their daily lives. Olala Njenga has been on the program a couple of times in the past 2 or 3 years or so. She runs her own marketing company. It's called Yellowwood Group out of Raleigh, North Carolina. Olala, good to have you back again.
Thank you.
How has it been for you with a shutdown? I mean, I imagine in a strategic marketing and communications firm, you do a little planning for these kinds of things.
We do a lot of planning, but I think there are some things that it is almost impossible to plan for. We have a client now in the pipeline that has a secondary relationship with a government agency, and the funding is questionable. And so they've kind of kicked back to us to say, you know, normally we would pay this in one big chunk, but can we get an installment relationship? You know, but we're kind of left holding the bag when I have to make payroll every other Thursday.
If the shutdown ends today, how long do you think it would be before your clients would feel confident enough and your cash flow would be strong enough for you not to worry anymore?
Ooh, that's a juicy question. It's almost kind of loaded, actually. I think fundamentally what's happening right now has really shaken the comfort level for small business owners in general. And even if we were to recover from it quickly, there will always be that thing in the back of most small business owners' mind. So I don't know if we'll ever really be sure, Kai, and feel good that, you know, someone's got our back. We can continue to go back to business as usual. I think once you get a shake like that, fundamentally, it just changes how you look at the role of government, and it changes whether or not you believe the government is really there to protect your interest.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, Olala. Are you angry at all this, or are you frustrated and resigned?
I think I'm working through the final pieces of anger. You know, I think that being angry is more about, can we get to the policy making and get off the puffery, get off the politics, get off the grandstanding, and really put the needs of the people at the forefront of the dialogue and stop playing this game of chicken. So I'm at the end of anger, and I'm almost making my ascendant to just numb. I'm just numb. Yeah. I'm frustrated. I'm numb. I'm overwhelmed. I'm tired. And at the end of the day, I still got a company to run, and I still have a team to lead.
Olala Njenga is the CEO of Yellowwood Group out of Raleigh, North Carolina. It does strategic communications and marketing. Olala, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's say you need to borrow money, but your credit rating is lousy, or you don't have a credit rating at all, so you can't really go to a bank, can you? There are workarounds, of course. In some immigrant communities, one solution is to join what's called a community lending circle. People pool their money, then they take turns getting loans from each other, basically. In San Francisco, there's a group that's giving the idea of lending circles a twist of sorts. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our story about the Mission Asset Fund.
The Mission Asset Fund's office is in a mostly Latino, mostly working class section of San Francisco. But the Mission District's been gentrifying, with Twitter's offices and trendy new restaurants nearby. Jose Quiñones, the founder of the fund, shows me around the neighborhood.
Wells Fargo has two branches here. And right next to the banks, there's some payday lender or check casher. We actually walked up and down Mission Street and counted more financial establishments than Mexican restaurants.
So the problem isn't a lack of banks. Quiñones says it's that many poor people can't borrow from them because they don't have good credit. Many immigrant families don't have any credit.
In our economy, credit is currency. You know, without credit, without access to capital, without access to loans, you know, people cannot buy houses, they cannot buy cars, they cannot invest in their businesses.
Quiñones says plenty of loans are already circulating here through informal community lending circles. Every month, each person puts in, say, $100. Each successive month, the next borrower in line takes the pot, maybe $1,000. The Mission Asset Fund formalizes this arrangement with contracts and documentation. They're called cestas in Spanish, like a collection basket in a church. A new cesta is launching. Mission Asset Fund brings the borrowers together. They each have to establish a bank account. Not everyone has one. Then the fund tracks each payment and provides that information to the credit bureaus, TransUnion and Experian. Elsie Diaz joined today. She's 67 and came here from El Salvador to work as a nurse. She's trying to repair her credit.
My credit, it was very good, but trying to help one person, I don't say names. I make a mistake that I lend my car. She spent everything under my name, but the record, it is for me.
Getting back in the good graces of the credit bureaus could affect everything from renting an apartment to getting a credit card, says Quiñones.
We see that our participants increase their credit scores by an average like 168 points. What they now have is access to low-cost loans in the financial marketplace.
What makes what Mission Asset Fund is doing so powerful, it's recognizing that one's credit profile is in and of itself an asset.
Jennifer Tesher at the Center for Financial Services Innovation admits she was a skeptic. Her group helped fund a study of whether the model would work in other poor communities, especially non-immigrant ones. Now the fund is helping to roll out similar programs in other cities.
Jose and his organization don't actually need a lot of capital, right? They can use the capital that already is flowing through communities.
Which isn't very much. After all, these are poor communities. And the fund's not really bringing new money in, at least not directly. Joyce Klein works on microlending at the Aspen Institute.
A small loan isn't enough to build a business on, but it can become sort of that first piece to get people where they're able to then borrow money from more established sources.
Quiñones is a realist about this.
We're not a lender, and we're not a bank, and we don't want to be those things because we could never have enough capital to meet the needs that are out there. We don't need another bank or another credit union. All we need is better borrowers.
Borrowers, by the way, who get to decide on their own what to use the money for.
Well, hopefully I'm going to be paying for school.
Juan Clavel is 22 and wants to open an auto mechanics shop. He just joined a Cesta. He'll put in $100 a month and get back $600 in one lump sum.
But it's a little tempting because I got it near my birthday, so I might just use it for like a little mini vacation or something.
Fine by the Mission Asset Fund, as long as Clavel pays on time every month and keeps building his credit. The fund's default rate is just 1%. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There is word today that a candy company may be getting out of the diet business. The Swiss food conglomerate Nestle is rumored to be interested in selling the weight loss company Jenny Craig. Nothing has been confirmed, but Nestle did say last week it has plans to dump some of its underperforming businesses. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler looks at the belt tightening in the diet industry.
Jenny Craig got rave testimonials from celebrities like Valerie Bertinelli.
I wouldn't be enjoying my life had I not gone to that Jenny Craig Center 5 years ago.
But industry analysts like Aaron Lash at Morningstar say Americans are turning to Jenny Craig less and less.
Jenny Craig has been a business that has had a tough go over the last few years, and so the rumors aren't all that surprising.
Sales at Jenny Craig have been declining for the past 3 years in a row, according to John LaRosa, who tracks the diet market for Market Data Enterprises.
You have to buy their company brand of food, which costs $400 a month. And in this economy, dieters just don't have that kind of money to spend on a weight loss program anymore.
In fact, LaRosa describes the company's business model this way.
Jenny Craig is basically a food company. 90% of their revenues come from their company brand of food.
Consumers are spending less on expensive diet foods and spending more on technologies like Jawbone and Fitbit. Those monitor people's bodies with electronics so people like my colleague Megan Ubelacker can track their weight loss minute by minute.
So far today, I have walked 6,589 steps. I have burned 1,393 calories and walked 2.81 miles.
Also, a bunch of new websites offer diet guidance for cheap or free. LaRosa says 85% of dieters now prefer to lose weight on a do-it-yourself program, trying to trim their waistbands without cutting into their wallets. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Alice Munro won the Nobel Prize for Literature today. It is a surprise every year, of course, who's going to win that prize, but perhaps a bit more so this year because Munro is a short story writer. It's a genre that hasn't gotten a lot of love from the Nobel Committee, in part because it hasn't gotten a lot of love from publishers. Sally Herships explains why it's so tough to make it as a short story writer and how Ms. Munro managed to do it.
So you want to be a writer, thinking of shopping a collection of short stories to launch your career? Here's a plot twist for you.
When an author comes to me with a book of short stories, My response is always, oh dear.
Sam Stoloff is vice president and a senior agent at the Francis Golden Literary Agency.
Aren't you working on a novel? Because short stories are very hard to sell.
Writers often work up to a novel by crafting short stories. But Stoloff says what fiction readers want, and therefore publishers, is an immersive experience. And short stories don't give you much time to settle in. But just like a complex character, the publishing industry feels conflicted about the short story. Sarah Weinman is an editor with Publishers Marketplace.
For every example that shows that short stories can't sell, you have another counterexample that shows that they can.
Jhumpa Lahiri, George Saunders, Karen Russell. But despite the success stories, it's still really hard to build a career as a short story writer. In Alice Munro's case, Weinman says she published her first book in the 60s when the publishing industry was less corporate, sleepier, and friendlier than today.
What it really comes down to for Alice Munro is her stories are incredible. The range of emotions that are contained in her stories are just, like, stupefyingly good.
Incredible stories get incredible distribution. Munro's work has appeared in landmark publications like The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and The Paris Review. It's that kind of exposure that convinces publishers it's worth taking a risk on a collection. And that's what a career writing short stories is all about. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which the government shutdown becomes almost poetic, time is literally standing still in the United States Senate. The Washington newspaper Roll Call reports today that the 194-year-old Ohio clock, which has been standing outside the Senate chamber since 1859, stopped ticking at 12:14 Wednesday afternoon because the staff at the office of the Senate curator that is responsible for keeping the thing wound has been, yes, furloughed. They have been. All right, we are done. That is Marketplace from APM on this, what, Thursday it is today. The Dow up 323 points, 2.1% on rumors of a deal on the debt limit, not the shutdown, though. The NASDAQ bounced up 82 points, 2.25%. The S&P 500 gained 36 points, 2.1%. John Buckley, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. My name is Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.